This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. A lawsuit filed last Thursday in U.S. District Court against Murray businessman Chuck Jones and several of his associates and businesses alleges Jones used companies he owned to infringe the copyrights of several textbook publishers. McGraw-Hill and Pearson Education allege Jones and his associates produced counterfeit covers for international editions of their textbooks, allowing him to sell them and rent them as U.S. editions for a significant profit. Shelley Baskin spoke to attorney Carl Means about the case. Means is the chair of the Intellectual Property Practice Group for the Shulman Rogers Law Firm in Potomac, Maryland.
So, Carl, how often do cases like the Jones case come about?
They have, in recent months, come up on a fairly regular basis. There is, in fact, a textbook-related copyright case that will be heard by the Supreme Court in October. This is not uncommon.
In this case in particular, one of the witnesses that is cited in McGraw-Hill and Pearson's complaint states that at some points they were counterfeiting maybe up to 10,000 books per month. Would this be a big case for this, or is this on the smaller scale of operations like this?
I would think that this was a fairly large operation. 10,000 books to be what they refer to as being subject to a chop shop operation, having their covers removed, having new covers created and then rebound. 10,000 books can be quite a few. And if you think about the average cost of today's college textbook, if each of those 10,000 books cost at retail when sold to a student $100, you're talking about a pretty substantial amount of money.
It looks like what they're requesting was that a restraining order be filed so that, I guess, evidence and other things couldn't be destroyed, attempting to hide what was going on. And that seems like it would be the first step in more litigation. Is that a fairly safe assumption?
Yeah, it's the first step. They're going to request those kinds of restraining orders, either a temporary restraining order or some sort of injunction. They're going to ask for that on the front end. I think you're right to avoid this destruction of any evidence. They want things frozen where they are. But they are probably also asking for it because at this time of year, we're, a month into most academic calendars. They could have been looking at the loss of a substantial amount of revenue if they were allowed to conduct this activity at the beginning of yet another semester. So I'm sure that they wanted it stopped as quickly as possible. The other thing that's important in these cases is usually if you can get it stopped immediately, if you cut off the cash flow that an infringer is making, it pretty much takes the wind out of their sails. Sometimes you don't even get to ultimately a final decision. The case will settle because if they're not making any money, it's just not worth it to them. So if you can put the brakes on it right away, sometimes that's really all the relief you really need.
And yeah, that was something I was wondering, is if a settlement in cases like this is likely. And you say, once the money stops, it usually is a settlement?
That's often the case, yes, because then it's really not in anybody's interest to let it drag on forever. Now, it really depends on how much of a fight the defendants put up in this case. The penalties for copyright infringement can be fairly steep. The penalties for trademark infringement, if it's found that it was a willful trademark infringement, in some cases can be tripled. You can get treble damages. They can also recover potentially all of their attorney's fees. So it also sort of depends on exactly how much money the defendants have. If they're never going to be able to pay the damages, maybe it's not worth it to go all the way to judgment. They'll settle for, 50 cents on the dollar or some lesser amount and be done with it.
And what kind of things are the plaintiffs looking for when trying to litigate these copyright and counterfeiting cases?
My guess is in this case that they will actually try to recover some damages because they can probably point to at least circumstantial evidence that the infringing activity that went on here had a direct impact on their sales and their revenues, their bottom line. Some companies in some industries will never hope to recover damages because the damages are far too uncertain. I mean, they undertake infringement suits specifically to get the operation shut down, to stop whatever activity it is that's creating the infringement. And they don't have any expectation that they'll get damages. But I suspect in this case that McGraw-Hill and Pearson will be looking for some sort of damage payment.
And so what about criminal charges? Hypothetically, how often do those arise from cases like this?
Not as often as you might think. It really depends on the dollars that are involved and whether or not some of the activities go a little deeper than simply, and I say simply, although it can be really very complex, but just some sort of copyright or trademark infringement. Sometimes there are criminal enterprises here that are tied into other activities. There could be some level of fraud involved here or some type of, you know, potentially an income tax related crime. It's going to be a little easier to get the U.S. attorney or the state's attorney to pay attention and to undertake an investigation in those circumstances. Usually, if it's just purely copyright or trademark infringement, they leave all of the enforcement to the civil side and they don't get very involved. It's out there, but it's not likely unless there's something else to it.
You know, obviously we can't speculate on the outcome of the case just because this is, you know, very early on and we don't have all the information. But from what from your knowledge, does this complaint look fairly solid against Mr. Jones?
The complaint itself, yes, looks fairly solid. And I believe that there are some news reports out there with comments from the plaintiffs here, from McGraw-Hill and from Pearson, that they ordered actual books from some of these companies before the lawsuit was filed. And if they have evidence in hand, physical evidence, showing that the international editions were in fact adulterated and then rebound and changes were made, then yeah, I think it probably is a fairly solid case. The other thing that the publishers here have going in their favor is this other case that's going to be heard in October. A different publisher, John Wiley and Sons, brought a lawsuit against an individual who imported international editions of textbooks that were produced abroad. And he didn't do anything to them. He just basically brought them into the country after buying them overseas and sold them on eBay. And the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld a decision that he's liable for copyright infringement for that activity. This lawsuit being brought in New York is within the Second Circuit. So there is precedent out there. There's a prior case that suggests even if Southeastern Book or the other company, College Book, didn't do anything to the books, if all they did was buy them abroad and bring them into the country and then attempt to resell them, even that might be a problem. The fact that they went and adulterated the books and then attempted to pass them off as something else just makes things worse.
Well, Carl, I appreciate you joining me today.
Not a problem. Thank you very much.
You can find out more about the ongoing litigation online at WKMS.org.
The National Institutes of Health says hearing loss is the third most common health issue in the United States behind arthritis and heart disease. Fully 16% of our region's population deals with hearing loss. Kate Lochte speaks with the executive director of the Kentucky Commission on the Deaf and Hard of Hearing, Virginia Moore, and a commission staff advisor who is deaf, Anita Dowd.
I was astounded to see the statistics about the deaf and hard of hearing population in western Kentucky. By my figuring, almost every county around us has about a 16% rate of people who are dealing with it.
That is true. You know, throughout the Commonwealth, we're talking about approximately 647,000 deaf and hard of hearing, and this is a huge issue. Hearing loss, it's one in five for teenagers, approximately 20% as they get older is going to experience this loss as well. This is a tremendous problem. It actually makes individuals feel very isolated as hearing loss, as you experience it, you're separated from individuals in communication.
It seems to be an extreme energy drain as well. I live with a person who has hearing impairment, and he is a superb lip reader, but you can tell that he really is making an effort every time you speak to factor what is being said.
Yes, this is Anita, and I am a profoundly deaf individual, but because I acquired my hearing loss after I had learned speech, I've still maintained my ability to speak. So that's very misleading to some people. But you mentioned lip reading, and what a lot of people don't realize is that studies have shown that lip reading at best is only 35% accurate. So that leaves a huge margin of error, and it's all a game of guessing and filling in the blanks. So it does lead to frustrations and some difficulties.
And the commission's main role is to protect the civil rights of the deaf and hard of hearing population so that, in fact, sign language becomes prevalent, communications issues are solved. Tell us a little bit of the headway being made in those areas.
Well, in fact, another person in the room with us today is signing for Anita Dowd, Katie Huber. She is a licensed interpreter here in the state of Kentucky, and she is signing to Anita. Like she said, she speaks well for herself, but she needs sign language to understand exactly what's going on. In the state of Kentucky, we have been able to help enforce and pass legislation to have interpreters be licensed. Not all states require licensure. Interpreters are certified in other states, but here to interpret here in the state of Kentucky, you need to be licensed. This is very important to the deaf community because you then are looking at standard of quality of communication. And when you standardize the interpreters, as interpreters are being used in the school system for young individuals, they're getting the best possible communication. We were able to help push the efforts on that. It is very important that we also look at the continuum of hearing loss and the continuum of communication. Not everyone, especially if they lose their hearing later in life, is going to depend on sign language. We would encourage different methods of communication. We've worked with the hospitals in encouraging them to include different types of access, which may include a UbiDuo, which is a typing system, which has two keyboards, and you can type back and forth quickly to communicate with an individual who has a hearing loss. Or we have also worked with the hospital associations to include video conferencing capabilities. So whereas if you do not have an interpreter immediately, we always encourage a live interpreter when an interpreter is needed. But if you do not have one immediately, the hospitals have the ability to bring in video conferencing and a captioning unit. Someone remotely can interpret on the screen what the doctor and the patient is needing. Also, remote captioning. The doctor can speak to the patient, and someone remotely will caption. This can be on a computer screen or whatever. That is also a type of access that helps hard of hearing individuals get complete communication and understanding. So we're promoting all different methods of communication, different modalities, just like you said, trying to make sure that individuals are able to live their life here in the state of Kentucky to the fullest extent. If you are a Kentuckian and you have a need for an amplified phone or a captioned phone, one is available to you for free. Actually, it's on your phone bill. It's the Telecommunications Act, and it's 4 cents. Everyone is paying for this, so we're able to access this to be able to provide individuals who have a need for these free phones. These are not phones you can go to Kmart and purchase. The captioning phone is a wonderful device. It allows individuals like Anita to speak for herself, but to read what the other individual is saying back to them. In addition to that, we've included the wireless cell phone as a part of the program. So individuals also have a choice of providing, obtaining a wireless cell phone. One of the reasons why we included the wireless cell phone is for emergency preparedness. If we have just a little bit of time, Anita's got a small story that included her, and this is one of the reasons why we are pushing for the wireless cell phone to be included in the program.
I was living as a single mom living in a mobile home, which happened to be situated on a hill, and we had a large storm move in. And in the middle of the night, I woke up, because my home was actually rocking back and forth. Both of my children have a hearing loss as well. So I quickly gathered up the kids, and of course we couldn't really see each other well enough to communicate, but we got in the bathtub. And because I did have a wireless phone, I was able to contact a coworker who lived in another part of the state who could then look at the TV where he lived and explain to me exactly what was going on and when to expect it to be over and what was happening, because I thought the world was coming to an end. It really allowed me some comfort to know that it was going to be over, equal access to what was going on. I really feel passionately about the wireless program, especially when it comes to emergency preparedness.
This is a legislation that we passed here as a state agency and is a part of our state and is not a soft grant. It is a part of our state, and anyone who has a hearing loss that could benefit that live here in the state of Kentucky would be eligible to apply. Helen Keller was asked, if you had a choice to be blind or deaf, which would you choose? She said, blindness separates me from objects, but deafness separates me from people.
Kentucky Commission on the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Executive Director Virginia Moore says that her goals include improvements for deaf inmates in the correctional system and equal access to educational opportunities for deaf and hard of hearing children. You can find more about their services at kcdhh.org.
And next up, Tracy Ross talks Murray State University basketball with the voice of the Racers, Neil Bradley.
Some exciting news for the Murray State Racer hoops team. They're one of 13 schools that will be featured on ESPNU's Midnight Madness.
Yes, I think that'll start at 8 local time and go till midnight on the 12th of October on ESPNU. Miles Simon, the standout at Arizona, is going to be coming in with ESPNU. He'll do the reports from here, but the Racers are the only so-called, I know some folks don't like the term mid-major, but that's what they're called, whether you like it or not, but they're the only so-called mid-major that'll be featured. Kentucky, Kansas, North Carolina, that's some pretty mighty fine company there. I think Duke is in there too. So the schools that you normally would hear from are in. But the Racers are too. It'll be a really special night, and to have that kind of coverage, I think, you know, you talk about getting benefits from last year when you're a mid-major team and you crack the top 10, have an amazing winning streak, and they're still feeding off of that. I don't know how far that's going to take them this year, but for the preseason, it's going to be great. And Tracy, they have a lot of special things that are going to be planned that night. I know some students will be able to compete for some cash and things like that. I think maybe $10,000 or something along that line. I know GoRacers.com has some of the details. And then a few surprises. If you've been a Racer basketball fan in any of the championship seasons, you might want to show up because there will be some fun things that night.
I want to touch on what you said about the fruits of the great season last year. Have we started to see any trickle-down effect to recruiting based on the high-profile nature of the program?
Yeah, I think where you really do see it is in the recruiting, because just look at who the Racers are in with in all the recruiting services, with three-star guys, two-star guys, and then look at where the rest of the OVC is involved. So we're after a little bit higher quality of an athlete in most of these battles. This last kid that I think verbaled to Murray State a couple of weeks ago, I mean, it's, you know, Wichita State. I think Gonzaga had talked to him, Murray State. I mean, you start to get into conversations that you weren't in earlier. And I think that's what you're doing. You're getting a higher caliber player. Now, you know, you get into a Duke, Kentucky, North Carolina, Murray State, probably going to lose that one. But, you take the steps you can take, and you can do very well in the world of college basketball doing it, the way Gonzaga has done it. You get Creighton, Wichita State, Murray State. I know they want to be right in there where they're in the national conversation. They're, if not in the top 25, at least bubbling under it on a yearly basis. And with the recruiting avenues that I think that season opened up, based on the good recruiters we have in place already and the coaching staff, it's going to pay dividends, not just this next recruiting season, but maybe for a few to come.
Is it fair to say, and this is not a disparaging remark to the OVC, but is it fair to say that as a basketball program, Murray State, now in the eyes of the casual fan, has transcended the OVC in much the same way that Butler and Gonzaga and Wichita State have?
You could have said that before last summer, but then Belmont decided they were coming to the OVC. So now you have another team They're used to winning 30 games. They're used to winning 25 or more every year. They're used to winning conference championships, used to going to the NCAA tournament and having success in postseason play. All that's going to do is elevate the OVC. And to me, that's what I've said all along. I have heard fans before say, why don't we get out of the conference? And I know in some areas that might be something that might be good, but when you take a look at travel budgets, because you have to travel those same teams for softball, for volleyball, for women's basketball, and they may not have the revenue opportunities that some of the other sports do, then suddenly it becomes very, very cost prohibitive. I mean, you're talking just tons of money. You know, take Boise State. They're in the Big East and they're in the Big West. Amazing what their travel budget will be, but because they're sharing FBS money, they'll probably be able to afford that. But at our level, that just will not happen.
With Belmont and Murray State, 0 to 100. What are the odds the OVC gets two bids with those two schools?
It's a possibility. In fact, a writer at one of the websites has already written about the possibility of a couple of bids. So I think it's a possibility. But for the Racers to do that, you have to look at their early part of the schedule, and they're going to have to, just like last year, get a lot of wins early. It's not a spot when you're in the OVC where you can go 6-5 in your early part and then kill it in the conference. You're not getting in a large bid unless you've got a couple of upsets against big teams. And the Racers don't have a lot of marquee teams. They have a solid schedule, but there's not a lot of, you know, top 10 teams where they can knock a couple off and solidify an at-large bid. So it's a possibility, but I still think it's a long shot. It's only happened once in league history.
Neil Bradley, the voice of the Racers. We'll talk to you in a few weeks.
Thanks.
After the break, protecting your privacy on Facebook and going back to your roots, in a manner of speaking. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Studies have shown that the human brain, for all of its intelligence and reasoning, prefers efficiency. Or, as a psychology professor of mine once said, the brain likes it easy. That could be why we only tend to scan, at best, things like website privacy policies. And when that involves the world's most ubiquitous social media site, that ignorance can be dangerous. To find out how to improve that state of affairs, I spoke with Murray State University journalism professor Elizabeth Thomas. She teaches and blogs on the subject of social media.
It seems as though you've come across something on Facebook regarding the privacy and security settings that has prompted a Facebook response. Could you tell us a little bit about what prompted it?
Sure. About a couple of weeks ago, there was a post that just kind of started spreading around campus, around town, probably all across the nation on Facebook, and it was a request to copy and paste as your status some specific instructions to protect your privacy, only they were not exactly accurate instructions. My advice to people when I talk about being careful with your own Facebook page, I usually say, if someone tells you cut and paste this as your status, don't do it because you need to verify the source.
Right.
Why are you telling me to do this? And they were saying that basically you had to ask your friends, you know, the people who were your friends on your Facebook profile, to do something with, you know, with privacy settings to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is your friends can't protect your privacy. You protect your privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone with a Facebook profile has their own privacy settings. And you actually control every single thing you share. If you're on your timeline, you're posting a status update, there's a little tool. You hover over it. It's right there in every single status box, and it's called the audience selector or the inline audience selector. And you choose who can see everything you share. You can also change that after you've shared something. You can say just my friends. Mm-hmm. You can say my friends and their friends. My friends and their friends and their acquaintances. And the list goes on. Or you can say public. A while back, this used to be called everyone. That word is gone. Facebook changed its mind, and now it's called public to better describe what you're doing. That means anyone on the internet can find that post.
Right. So this is a way that people are doing, for instance, illicit data mining.
Yes. Definitely there are hacks to people's Facebook accounts. It's happened to mine. I kind of live there a great deal of the time. I use it in the classroom. I use it in my consulting business. And I've had it happen to me. And I've gone back and worked with Facebook and changed my default privacy settings, gone into my account settings. There's a lot you can do, but it's up to you. Don't count on your friends and don't believe every, hey, copy and paste this as your status that comes out.
Well, it certainly seems as these problems may have increased or multiplied since Facebook's last security and privacy policy update. If people have been longtime users and are kind of like me and not exactly as on top of that as they ought to be, what do they do?
Well, if you've been on there a long time and you've never gone into your privacy settings, I would get in there right now. Every now and again, maybe every few months, if you're an avid user, change your password. These are things that can truly protect your information in your account. But also, if you go to someone else's timeline and post to it, really think about what you're posting and what information about yourself you're giving away, because they control what's posted on their timeline just as you control your own. If you've never looked at your own default settings, they're probably on whatever Facebook, you know, started in 2006 with,
right,
and that's probably going to be public. If you don't post anything that you don't mind everyone seeing or hearing, then what's the trouble? But, you know, personally, I try to use Facebook very professionally, even on my personal page.
Right.
I stay away from politics and religion. It's a happy, positive place, and I want to help educate through it. Other people, there are those that want to engage in debate. And you know what? That's the great thing about free speech in our country. But they should be thinking, who do I want to see this, and right, what could they do with that information?
Is this a problem within a certain demographic, a certain age group, or is it older users or is it younger users?
I think it goes across the board. You know, surprisingly, the predominant or the heaviest users of Facebook are 35 to 55-year-old women in America.
Really?
Yeah. The fastest growing group is women over the age of 85 right now. So, and the lesser users are actually the 18 to 24-year-olds or the 13 to 25-year-olds as Facebook groups them. And they use it very differently, I think. There are parents and grandparents and great-grandparents all across the nation that maybe said, I'm never going to be on Facebook. And now they want to see the pictures of the grandkids. So they've opened an account. It's new technology for them. And anything we can do to help them use it well and properly. But then you have the younger generation that has forgotten that maybe great-grandma's on my page and sees everything I post. And basically, once you put something out there publicly on Facebook, it's out there. So it's visible somewhere forever. And about 80% of employers are vetting new hires through Facebook. It's really important that you think before you post or you change the privacy setting. You can use Facebook lists. You can pick 10 people that you want to send the humorous cartoon or the joke or what I did last night to. Just pick those people. Put them in a list. If you're using Facebook on a mobile device, it's different, and it does go to default settings. So you actually have to go into your mobile device and find Facebook settings for that app and change the default if you don't want everything you do from your phone to locate you, number one, and to be public.
So if you're coming onto Facebook and basically go over your privacy settings with a fine-tooth comb, is what I'm hearing. What if the user is having difficulty with that? Because I know that sometimes policy, particularly the terms of agreement and so on and so forth, they get pretty far into the weeds.
Yeah, Facebook doesn't do a great job of notifying us. It sort of blatantly makes blanket changes, and I have a page where I just give, hey, this is what changed on Facebook this week. Here's why you want to know about it. I only have a couple hundred followers. It's not something I'm doing for any reason other than, hey, I'm on top of this and I'd like to help as many people as I can. There's a help screen up in the upper right of every single page. You can hover your mouse, a drop-down menu appears, and the very last word is help. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is type in your question. Facebook will have an answer for it. There a lot of the information's buried pretty deep, to be perfectly honest. But I read all those darn help screens, and they're well written. They're in layman's terms, and the information's in there. You just have to go looking for it. But there are a lot of people out there who are social media savvy. So and an older person, I say, hey, ask your grandchild. I bet they know exactly how to work that thing.
Well, what is the way that they would find that Facebook page? Someone who was interested in monitoring these changes, how would they find that?
Well, if you did facebook.com/everythingcreative with a capital E, a capital T, and a capital C, all as one word, you would come up on a page where there's a lot, and you can scroll down and see past almost translations of changes through time, mm-hmm. starting about 2 years ago.
Are there any other sources for people that want to find their way through the deep, dark jungle of Facebook?
Tons. PR Daily News does a lot of that. Social Media Explorer, Social Media Examiner. You can basically Google help with social media.
Certainly good advice. Well, thank you very much for coming up to speak with us about this very important subject and an increasingly important platform.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Elizabeth Thomas is a professor of journalism at Murray State University. She studies social media. Commentator Celia Brewer returned to Western Kentucky 8 years ago, but in another completely different way, she's also gone back to her roots.
In an episode of the 50s sitcom The Honeymooners, Ralph Cramden comes home to find his wife Alice chatting with her friend Trixie. Ralph, never one for the delicate touch, tries to compliment Trixie on her recent trip to the beauty parlor. "Your hairdo looks nice," he says, "and the color is almost natural." Natural is sort of an elusive concept these days, especially on food labels. Regarding human hair, there are dozens of dyes on the market that mimic its many hues. There are also lots of colors not found in nature. My first weeks of teaching at Murray State have reminded me that young people, girls especially, like to experiment with outrageous colors on their crowning glory. More power to them. Later on in life, it will be difficult to carry this off. No, what gets me is the pressure on us baby boomers to mask our gray hair, to present a front to the world that is, well, a pretense. The hair color companies count on this. In the myriad of boxes on supermarket shelves, Clairol and L'Oreal supply what is in great demand. Hairstylists do too, catering to clients who prefer a professional job at much greater cost. I do understand the desire that many people have to stay young-looking, especially among women. The job market in particular and our culture in general are hard on older people, unlike other cultures where the elderly are respected and often revered for their wisdom. Try to imagine a stoic 75-year-old Japanese woman with, say, fuchsia hair. As I watched Diane Sawyer covering the Democratic National Convention, I was struck by how blonde her hair continues to be. This is unusual for any woman born in 1945, even in Glasgow, Kentucky. Yes, I know the pressure to look young is greater for women on TV. Just picture commentator James Carville, whose hair color is no longer even an issue. He is completely bald. This double standard applies to us common folk as well. Here in Western Kentucky, for many couples in my generation, the man's hair has turned gray, for those who still have hair, but time has stopped for their wives. These women in their 60s and 70s have not a single wisp of it. Brunettes, blondes, and even redheads, they remain. And it's too late in life to claim that only their hairdresser knows for sure. In the interest of full disclosure, I confess that for a while I too colored my hair. It started after church one day in New Orleans, when a friend of mine touched the gray strands on my temples among the dark auburn brown of my thick head of hair. "Why not get rid of these?" she suggested. Thus began a period where I either dyed my own hair or had it done professionally. The battle of the roots had begun. Oh, the embarrassment when those gray shoots started sprouting, the compulsion to trade reality in for illusion once again. Finally, I decided that I had had enough. Enough hassle, enough sham, not to mention the expense. It was actually a relief to embrace my total grayness, to go back to my feminist roots. No more vigilance in front of the bathroom mirror, worrying, is it time to color again? Then, do I dye it myself or pay the colorist to make it look fabulous? Fabulous, yes, and fake. Paul McCartney is on wife number 3 now. His children by first wife Linda are in their 40s. Yet the tabloids show pictures of the former Beatle frolicking on some tropical beach, a 70-year-old man in a 70-year-old body, topped off by what is clearly a head of hair dyed brown. You would think this talented tunesmith, his lordship, would be proud of the long and winding road of his life's journey and would embrace his grayness. Memo to Sir Paul. Take a cue from Emmylou Harris. Her hair is silver white, and she looks fabulous.
Celia Brewer is a writer who lives in Mayfield. She's been a big fan of Emmylou Harris for years.
When we come back, we get a preview of what's playing this weekend at Maiden Alley Cinema in Paducah and take a look at the art form of printmaking. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
Me and my best friend Lillian and her blue tick hound dog Eddie, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town. Me and Lillian.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Public radio returns to the big screen this week at Paducah's Maiden Alley Cinema, following the Garrison Keillor documentary, The Man on the Radio in the Red Shoes, and the Robert Altman-helmed movie version of A Prairie Home Companion. This American Life host Ira Glass presents Sleepwalk With Me, a film loosely based on the real-life experiences of comedian Mike Birbiglia. Birbiglia is a frequent contributor to This American Life, and he suffers from rapid eye movement behavior disorder. His efforts to control the resulting sleepwalking, jumpstart his career, and maintain his relationships form the basis for the movie. Maiden Alley's Larry Thomas and I take a look at Sleepwalk With Me.
I'm going to tell you a story, and it's true. I always have to tell people that because inevitably someone will come up to me and they'll be like, is that true? And I'll be like, yeah. And they'll be like, was it? I don't know how to respond to that. Like, I guess I could say it louder, you know, like, yeah. And they'd be like, it's probably true. Say it louder.
And now the big comedian, Matt Pandapiglio.
So this is kind of a red letter event for public radio listeners.
It is, absolutely, especially if you're a fan of This American Life. This was created by one of the guys on the show and was co-written by Ira Glass and actually has become like sort of a, you know, a little running thing on the program from time to time.
Hmm.
Birbiglia directed and co-wrote and stars and actually based this on his life, is a guy who was a stand-up comic, and he has a sleeping disorder called REM behavior disorder. One night in a motel, he jumps through a window while he's asleep and has to have stitches in his leg and everything else. And his doctor tells him that he has to start using a sleeping bag and to wear mittens so he can't get out of it. Well, that, you know, that sounds like great stuff for a stand-up, if you know, but it's real life.
Mm-hmm.
So he has taken that and used it as a jumping-off point to do a fictional film about a real problem, about a real person himself, with a great cast, and has come up with something that, you know, it's almost kind of Woody Allen-ish.
Really?
Yeah.
You see that potential in Mike Birbiglia?
Well, you know, it's possible. I mean, he is a comedian. He is a storyteller. He does have personality, and, you know, he seems to know how to put his stuff together in order to make it very coherent. The rest of the cast, as I mentioned, was terrific. Lauren Ambrose plays his girlfriend.
Right.
Loudon Wainwright III is Uncle Max.
Really?
There's a guy named, you probably don't know his name from his face, but it's James Rebhorn.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been in 100 movies usually as a bad guy or a politician or something.
Thin features.
In features, yes. And the great Carol Kane, who was in Annie Hall and Princess Bride and many other films.
You say you're going to go see the doctor.
You don't.
You say you want to be a comedian. You're a bartender. I mean, pick a clan and stick with it.
He's kidding, but he's not as funny as you.
So it's no slouch of a production. And it's just something totally off the wall and in many ways, you know, rather inspired. And by golly, it's darn interesting.
Well, it does certainly seem to be a very different premise. I mean, you don't often find that the obstacle for the protagonist to overcome is inability to get a decent and peaceful night's sleep.
Right. And also, you know, in the course of this, he finds that in playing all these terrible, lousy venues for comedians, he starts to improve his material, you know, out of necessity.
Well, kind of like it has in real life.
Yeah, exactly.
One day I asked my girlfriend, what do you fear most? And she said, I fear you'll meet someone else and you'll leave me and I'll be all alone. And she said, what do you fear most? And I said, bears.
Well, this has actually gotten quite a few good notices.
Oh, absolutely.
So is this a good date movie, a good, if you happen to be listening to public radio or listening to this station, it's something you might want to check out?
Oh, absolutely. If for public radio people, it's a perfect movie to see. It's also a first movie for this guy, which is, you know, may lead to bigger and better things if he takes the cue from real life and starts, you know, putting more effort into other movies. You know, nothing wrong with this one, but he can only go up.
So it's even more perfect than The Man on the Radio and the Red Shoes?
Well, let's not get carried away.
Nice shirt, loser. Sorry. No, I like it. It's nice.
You can find showtimes at our website, wkms.org.
Printmaking as an art form has existed for hundreds of years, but it experienced a revival in the 1960s and 70s, bringing new life into art prints. The term fine art printmaking covers a long list of art techniques and styles, as Murray State University Galleries Director Colin Nesbitt knows. In addition to being a curator, he's also an artist. Nesbitt holds an MFA in printmaking and drawing from Brigham Young University. Nesbitt joined Angela Hatton to talk a little about this niche in the art world.
So let's start with some definitions here. When we say that somebody makes prints and we're talking about fine art printmaking, what exactly is that?
Well, what we're really talking about are limited edition prints. And so they're typically handmade prints that are done by artists, craftsmen, and they're always hand signed. So you have some of the artist hand in there. They are signing that final kind of document that you're looking at. But what is unique about prints is the ability to distribute them much easier, be in a lot of exhibitions at the same time. And so artists kind of like them because they can be in two places at once. And a lot of collectors really like them because they're much less expensive than, say, like an oil painting or something like that.
And you say that they're typically handmade. Do they have to be handmade?
Lately, there have been some advances in people kind of pushing for digital prints to be included in the lexicon of fine art printmaking. And a lot of hardcore printmakers really push back against that, and they feel that those people aren't really completely integrated into the print world. And so there's a lot of kind of nice soap opera kind of stuff going on in the print world. A lot of really, really trained people trying to navigate where they belong in this community.
When you're producing a print, obviously you can then reproduce it. But when you're doing that, how long does it actually take to make a print before you can then reproduce it?
Ooh, I mean, that really depends. Mm-hmm. If you're working with something that's in the relief family, like a wood block or something like that, you're taking knives and carving into like a wood surface, and then you could print that quite quickly. There's really no preparation to the wood. You could run it through a press after it's been inked up, and that's kind of the end of it. With some of the more exotic forms of printmaking, it can take a lot longer. And so,
when you say a lot longer, you know, what are we talking about?
So, for instance, in stone lithography, you would take a piece of Bavarian limestone. It's a very specific type of limestone from Germany. It has no fossils in it. It's this porous matrix that you can work on, and you're drawing with grease pencils and touches and all of these things that kind of work their way into the stone. You then have to etch that, roll it up with ink, etch it again, and then you're kind of ready to print. And that process, you know, after you get done with the drawing, which takes as long as you'd like to take in the drawing process, that probably takes a hard 3 hours just to get ready to print. But once you're ready to print, you could print hundreds.
So lithography, what exactly is that?
So lithography is Greek for stone writing, lithos meaning stone and graphy alluding to writing. I barely speak English, so I mean that's a ballpark. Essentially what happened was there was a playwright in Germany named Senefelder, and what he was trying to do was invent a cheaper way to print. While we had the Gutenberg press and printing in that form, it was still very expensive because you had to get a typesetter to go in and do all this stuff, and it was very expensive to run a shop because you had all these tiny little pieces of metal that had words and graphics on them, and so it got pretty tedious, so that was obviously fairly expensive. And so the story anyway is that he took a piece of limestone and put a ham sandwich down on it, and the grease from the ham sandwich, I promise,
okay.
The grease from the ham sandwich left kind of a stain on the stone that when he was trying to work with it in other ways, that image accidentally printed. And so from there, he figured out if you draw with these grease pencils and these wax pencils, you can etch it into the surface and then reproduce that over and over again. So that's kind of the birth about 300 years ago-ish of lithography. So
yeah, very, very cool. I'm also interested in the people who collect prints, because from what I understand, printmakers will do limited runs of their print, their form. Maybe they'll do 10 or they'll do 25, and then there are no more. So tell me a little bit about collection.
One of the things that has kind of come up a couple times in printmaking's history is that printmakers, and this happened a bit more in Europe is my understanding, but printmakers would do a run, like for Picasso, for example. They would do this run, and then Picasso leaves. He signed all of the pieces, you know, and he numbered them and what have you. They didn't destroy the image that he printed from, and then the printmaker just prints more of them, kind of like money. So now we have 300 Picassos that we can sell, and they signed them themselves or didn't sign them, and it kind of pollutes the market because you didn't have this rare thing you thought you had. It's still rare, but it's not as rare as once believed. And so one of the things that Tamarind was really diehard about when they established kind of the groundwork for this new movement in America was when you are done with an edition, however big you want it, 10, 20, 100, whatever that is, you print something called a cancellation plate or a cancellation image. And so it's essentially the printmaker destroys the plate, takes a scraper or something like that to it, pours acid on it, and it shows that the piece has been destroyed and that no more can now be printed from this image. And so it kind of seals in that there's only 100 because we have evidence that this has been destroyed now. So the thing that's happened lately, giclées and things like this, mass-produced, not handmade prints, there's really no way to tell if the print that you have of this horse or whatever it is, if there's 25 of them or 2,000 of them. Because it was done digitally, there's no way to track down and figure out where the trail ends, really. That's a little bit problematic.
So with the ones today that are the limited runs, that they have the cancellation plate, I've heard that there are some people who want the first one or want the fifth one in the run. Is that
true? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone has a steez, and some people collect cancellation prints along with the print that they bought. A lot of people have a number that they like. Some people, you buy your lucky number, and so your whole collection of prints, they're all number sevens out of whatever the end count is. Some people like the first one. Some people like the last one. And then there are crazy theories that I've heard from collectors that are rather unfounded. I really have no idea how they came to this conclusion, but some people feel that the prints in the middle are a little bit better because the plates have kind of settled down a little bit and what have you. But the reality of it is that shouldn't be happening, A, if you're working with a good printmaker, and B, there's something called a BAT, a bonatier, and that means ready to pull. The artist kind of picks out the last print that's really the one that we will compare everything else to, the BAT. They sign that one, and every single print that's printed then is compared to the BAT to make sure that every image is exactly the same.
Colin Nesbitt, director of MSU Galleries, thanks so much for coming up and talking about printmaking.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance.
If you have comments or questions about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.